This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Willie Grimes spent nearly a quarter of a century in prison for a crime he did not commit. In 1987, he was falsely accused of raping a woman in Hickory, North Carolina. Despite little evidence against him, Willie was convicted and sentenced to life plus 9 years in prison. Willie has always maintained his innocence. While he was incarcerated, he wrote to lawyers, politicians, and anybody who would hear his story. Willie's case eventually landed on the desk of the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission. Attorneys with the commission were able to uncover new evidence that eventually led to Willie's release. And after more than two decades behind bars, he was exonerated in 2012. His story is chronicled in a new book called Ghost of the Innocent Man, A True Story of Trial and Redemption. Joining me now is Benjamin Racklin. He's the author of the book and speaks next Tuesday at Duke University and then Thursday at UNC Wilmington. Benjamin Racklin, welcome.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Willie Grimes is also with us. Hello, Willie.
Hello. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm going to ask you how you're doing. I gave a short recitation of your story. We'll hear details in a moment, but I'm wondering, as you look back over your ordeal, what's your sense of the criminal justice? How do you see what happened to you?
Well, from the beginning, I felt that criminal justice was just of something like a bit fate, just get people's behind bars. But on down the line, when I got in prison, I went to trying to do a lot of different things, which made me even feel worse because I could never get anything done. But eventually at the end, things went to happening and people went to falling in the right places. And it went to making me feel a whole lot better because I had been crying so long to try to get someone to just to look at it, whether they can help me or not. But eventually we got someone to look at it, and even they found evidence to help me and prove my innocence, which I knew I was innocent all the time, and which I was trying to tell them that, but no one wanted to listen. But now I feel good about different things of what people can get done if they're in the right places and willing to do what they want to do to help you.
Well, Benjamin Racklin, let's take us back to the beginning. Willie talked about along the line, people being able to prove his innocence. But, of course, that's not how our criminal justice system is set up. We're supposed to prove guilt. And they didn't do it in this case. They didn't prove it with evidence, but they managed to get a conviction. Take us back to the beginning and the story. And perhaps before we even tell the story of the crime itself and the trial, we should probably put this in context. Hickory, North Carolina, 1987. Set the scene for us. Benjamin?
Sure. So Willie had grown up in Lawndale, which is just a little bit north of Shelby, a little bit south of Hickory. Hickory is about an hour, it's a small town, about an hour northwest of Charlotte, near the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains. And Willie had arrived there in the 80s looking for work. It's a pretty rural area, and Hickory had manufacturing plants in a way that many of the surrounding towns did not. And so Willie was one of the folks who arrived in search of paying work.
Gets there. Tell us about the crime itself. What happened and how is it that Willie's name became associated with the rape that took place in Hickory in 1987?
Sure. That October of 87, an elderly woman was assaulted. A strange man showed up at her door, knocked, and forced his way inside and assaulted her and then fled into the darkness. Willie that night was at a house party well across town, every one of whose attendees later testified on behalf of his alibi, saying that that Willie had been with them. There was no possible way he could have committed this crime. But a neighbor of the victims first mentioned Willie's name, volunteered his name in conjunction with the crime. And subsequently, the victim herself believed she recognized Willie in a lineup. And that set in motion a series of unfortunate events leading to Willie's arrest and ultimately wrongful conviction for the crime.
Tell us about that arrest, Willie, because you heard that your name had been associated with this. You went to the police when you heard your name was connected with this. Tell us more about your reaction to hearing your name connected with this crime.
Yes, I was working during that day, and after I got off from work, I returned home. And Brenda Smith, which I was living with at the time, told me that police had been there searching for me because they had warrants for me. So I asked her for what, and she said she didn't know. They didn't say. And I said, well, I haven't did anything. Why don't you carry me up to the police station so I can find out what's going on? So she did so. She carried me to the police station. I talked to them. They act like they didn't know nothing about it, and they said Lee Hunt would be there in a few minutes, that he was the one who had the warrants.
That's the police officer, right?
He was the detective.
The detective.
Police officers had done gave him the warrants. So when he got there, he asked me, where had I been? I told him I had been working in this and that. He said, you know you was in big trouble. And I said, for what? Because I haven't did anything. So he went to find us, say I had, and I told him, no, you got to be wrong because I haven't did anything. So he said again, I said, I take a lie detector test or do anything because I know I haven't did anything. He told me, you better be quiet because you is in big trouble. And anything you say can be used against you. I said, but I haven't did anything. He said, don't say another word because you is in big trouble. So he told them to fingerprint me and lock me up at that time.
At that moment, you knew you were innocent. You'd been locked up for a crime you didn't commit. What were you thinking? You thinking this is going to be all cleared up, or what was going through your mind at that moment?
Well, at first, I wasn't even worrying about it because I knew I hadn't did anything. I felt that we would go to court and everything would be worth that, and I'd be going right back home. And while I was locked up in jail, my lawyer went to all the witnesses and got affidavits and got them signed and notarized. And he cried to come to the judge, this and that, but they wouldn't accept no of them. So it was a while after that before I seen him. So when I did see him, he said, look like we got to go to court because there's nothing he can get the judge to understand.
Well, Benjamin Racklin, you've done extensive research on the trial and its aftermath. Give us a sense of what went on in that trial, a lot of details and a lot of missteps along the way.
Yeah, I would say that, the transcript of Willie's trial reads really, in retrospect, really discouragingly. I mean, it's not by any means a model trial, not only by today's standards, but by the standards of the time. And it's discouraging in 2017 to read a trial unfold the way it did. One of the things I would say is that a common thinking is that a wrongful conviction is always the result of a bad actor, some sort of malpractice, whether that's an overzealous prosecutor or an insufficient defense attorney or a witness who's dishonest or some so-called expert who lies. That's true some of the time, but not all the time. Another thing that can happen in trial is that things can just go wrong, even if it's not explicitly and directly any one person's fault. And there are a lot of ways that can happen. One of the most obvious is that our understanding of what counts as evidence evolves over time. So there was a time, and in 1987, the time of Willie's arrest, and the following year at the time of his trial, we believed that witness identification, for example, was a flawless form of evidence. How could a person who had witnessed a crime ever be wrong about his or her recollection? We also thought, for example, that hair comparison was infallible, that if one hair looked microscopically consistent with another visually to an expert, someone who had studied that, then certainly there couldn't be any denying it. Our understanding of those things have changed over time with the advent of, on the one hand, DNA, and on the other hand, a series of more sophisticated scientific techniques and evaluations of those kinds of methods. And so it is possible for a trial to proceed without any explicitly bad actors, but still have an incorrect outcome. And in Willie's case, I would say there was some of each. There was some bad faith and also a series of misconceptions or limited understandings that coalesced in a kind of terribly perfect storm.
Well, let's talk about eyewitness evidence, for instance. To be honest, prosecutors and police have known for a long, long time. They just don't like to talk about it, that eyewitness testimony is the worst possible. They just don't bother to tell anybody. And they've known for a long time because they've seen it themselves, an eyewitness who will then, you know, report something that's preposterous, and they've seen it over and over. And this was known in 1987. But what's interesting in this case to me is that the eyewitness missed something pretty clear about Willie's physique that was not reported in reporting of the crime itself that should have been pretty clear evidence. I mean, talk about misidentification of Willie Grimes.
Sure. Well, let me sort of politely push back a little bit on the idea that police and prosecutors have known for so long that these are the worst forms of evidence. I mean, I think certainly there are some police and prosecutors who that description matches. I think also, though, that it's one thing to know something scientifically on paper. It's another thing for that scientific understanding to reach a more widespread understanding and to be incorporated into training. And the other thing is, I think it's hard even for responsible adults to imagine a scenario where a person in an acute situation could observe something with his or her own eyes and then recall it incorrectly. That happens. A whole number of studies have been conducted on it. But I don't think it's only bad faith or only evasion that results in people not always appreciating the scale of the problem. And I hasten to add that in this case, like many others, there was no bad faith on the part of the victim. I mean, she was the victim of assault. She had been through a traumatic situation. And, of course, we know now that trauma harms the accuracy of recollections and identifications. But that, like I said, that information can be hard to incorporate in real time if you're trying to solve a crime. And so, of course, the goal is to have policies in place that protect against what we know are the fallibilities of human memory while also respecting the experience of the people who are directly involved in trauma.
Willie had a pretty severe scar on his chest. The assailant had his shirt off, and that wasn't reported. And somehow that evidence, that never made its way into the trial.
That's right. I mean, really agree with what you're saying is that stuff you would think would be raised over the course of the trial. So the circumstances of the identification and the relative strengths and weaknesses, things that included, things it missed, you would think would be important for a jury to hear, including, for example, Willie was the wrong height, he was the wrong weight, there were physical marks on his body that had never come up in initial descriptions of the assailant. So absolutely, you're right about that. I just want to make sure that I don't project any ill intention on the part of the victim or the victim's family at all in this case, because I don't think that happened.
You experienced several roadblocks over the years in your fight for innocence. Tell us about then bringing this to the attention of the Innocence Inquiry Commission and what happened then.
Well, after I got baptized and got to know Brother Eddie Moose and Virginia Moose, they got very interested in me, in my case. And they believed in me and really believed that I was telling the truth, so they went to trying to reach out to try to find any kind of help that they could get me. So they heard of a lawyer in Charlotte which did cases like that. But when they went to him, they got him to read my transcript and paid him to read my transcript. But he came back and told them that it would cost too much money and they couldn't come up with the money and this and that to do research and background checks and things like that. But he said he did know someone that he worked with in Raleigh that did work like that for free. And he was referring to Chris Moomar because he was working on a case with her. So he referred my case to her and told her that he really felt that I was innocent from reading transcript. And from that beginning, that was the first time, you know, anyone really felt that I was innocent besides myself. And eventually, she got in touch with me and sent me a questionnaire. I signed and sent it back, and she sent for all the details of my case, so I had to file papers to get them from the clerk of court and this and that. And once she went to working on it, she came to a lot of blocks just like I did. And after 3 or 4 years, she just actually felt that she had to give up too because there was nothing else she could do. So I kept telling her they might have destroyed all the evidence in my case, but they had fingerprints that didn't match me that they wouldn't have put in my file, which they would have left them on the record, but they wouldn't have defrauded them. And she couldn't figure out what I was trying to tell her or this and that, but she went looking for them, searching for them anyway. But she couldn't find them. So she had came to a block. She couldn't do anything else, so she went to the senator at the time, which was fairly late, and went to talking to him about getting innocent inquiry started.
And that once did, they, go ahead, finish, please.
Once they did that, they got that started, and there was grants gave to them, which gave them power to go and search for things and get orders to do things that regular lawyers and things couldn't do.
Let me ask you now, you were exonerated in 2012. What was that moment like for you?
It was just like someone pouring a whole big tub of cold water on your butt. The cold water and ice turned to warm water. Made me feel like, you know, I was in a thing that I wanted to jump out of. I wanted to holler and cry. And it was just that. I mean, I felt so different. I didn't know what I could really wanted to do. And I didn't want to make my peoples and this and that look bad. But it was just something that I was never looking for, even though I knew I was innocent.
Willie Grimes, I want to thank you for being on the program, and Benjamin Racklin. Willie wrongly convicted and spent 24 years in prison. His story is chronicled in the new book, Ghost of the Innocent Man, A True Story of Trial and Redemption. Benjamin, the author of the book, and he speaks next Tuesday at Duke University and Thursday at UNC Wilmington. Gentlemen, thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Just ahead, a debut novel that shows off the good side of living in a small town. Stay tuned.